I won't be talking about many dates on here, but it's August 10th, 2011, and I realized that on August 8th, 1991, I had talked to my friend Will Sexton, whose birthday is today. He lived in Austin, I lived in Houston, and he said, when are you moving here, man? And I said, I'm probably coming up Friday or Saturday, and he was like, man, I'm going to turn 21 on Thursday, it's got to come up. That was the 10th of August. So I've lived here for 20 years straight in Austin. I wish I had an applause button. See, that's how I need a fart button and an applause button. So welcome to episode 2 of How Did I Get Here? I'm your host, Johnny Gowdy. I'm just going to talk when I come into this because I'm ready to. I just finished my interview with Lang Freeman from Sounds Under Radio. He's our guest today. Their band had a really interesting story. They came together and had some really good luck, and then were kind of put through the ringer. And when most bands, like a lot of marriages, are put through the test, both outside forces bringing them down and having a difficult time, they prevailed and made an incredible album, which Lang will be talking about. And he's here. So once again, I don't really want to blow a lot of smoke up everyone's ass, but it's a really great album. They're a really great band. They write amazing songs. They get a lot of attention outside of Austin. I'm sure they get some attention here in Austin as well. I'm looking forward to going to see them again soon. I haven't seen them in a while. Other than that, what else is going on? I've gotten some feedback from the first podcast, which I released just this morning. I don't know exactly when this one will come out. Maybe it'll come out over the weekend. I got some feedback, and that feedback was from a lady named Janie, who did enjoy my conversation with Susanna. I'm glad that she did. I'm glad. I hope other people did. I heard from my aunt. She really liked it, so that's a plus. I heard from a guy named Keeve in Lawrence, Kansas, who I know, and he suggested some guests for the show. And Keeve, I've talked to a lot of those guests, and they're going to come on the show as soon as they're able to. Let's talk about upcoming shows. Episode 3 will be Nathan Singleton. He's from a band called Sideshow Tragedy. He's coming in tomorrow to interview with me. And then the next day, I'm kind of putting these all together, which is kind of exciting. So the next day, I'm having Donnie Wynn come in for episode 4. He is a world-class musician, a drummer that's played on tons and tons of songs you've heard, a drummer with Robert Palmer, Brooks and Dunn. The guy is amazing, and we've done a lot of stuff together, and I enjoy his company. I enjoy talking to him. He's got a great outlook, and he's always looking for, he's always inspired, so he's a good conversation to have. Speaking of inspired, my conversation with Lang Freeman from Sounds Under Radio, which you're about to hear, was incredibly inspiring. It was great to hear the story of a band that overcame, hard times and came out stronger musically and in their personal relationships, which is something I've never really been able to do. So I find that fascinating and great. So here we are. How did I get here? Episode 2 is starting now, with Lang Freeman from Sounds Under Radio.
It's not your fault.
I still don't know how much to play of a song.
That seems like a good amount. Got to the chorus, you know.
That's a beautiful song.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
That song is called Sing, is mm-hmm. by the band Sounds Under Radio, and I'm joined by Lang Freeman, their singer.
Hello. Hello, everybody. Hello, Johnny.
We're actually friends.
Yeah.
Outside of microphones and headphones.
Yeah, like for real world friends.
Dude, I say hey to you whenever I see you. So Lang Freeman from Sounds Under Radio, that's their song Sing from their album My Communist Heart Meets My Capitalist Mind.
Right, right.
It's a political album.
It is,
record
sort
about
of.
Politics, it says, but more about the head versus the heart and how people cope with their agreements and disagreements.
Yeah, it's the title is sort of it's the metaphor. Like the record's politically charged, but has nothing to do with, like, you know, domestic affairs or international affairs. It's about the politics of the self, the politics of your heart and your head, and like the wars that you have internally and those sort of conflicts. And kind of thematically, the record's not like it's not a concept record per se, but it's a themed and thematic record, and all the songs sort of fit in that category. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's a universal theme, and it's a personal theme. So you wrote do you write from your own personal experiences?
I do, for the most part. You know, I sort of when I sit down to write, I always kind of write in records. You know, I have trouble writing, like, sitting down and saying, you know, I'm going to write this singular song. It sort of comes in spurts and comes in a series of 12 or 15 or you know, whatever, something that's going to become a record. But yeah, it mostly comes from personal experience, and sort of writing songs is my mechanism to cope with, you know, the problems that I feel are in my life and the things that I do that affect those around me. And this record in particular was definitely that.
So you work out your issues in music.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your songs.
Yeah, yeah. There's this band called The Tea Party, which was a band in sort of the early 2000s, late 90s. I was a huge fan of. They're from Canada. I don't think anybody in the States really knows who they are, but...
Yep, dude, they get more press than anyone I know. I see The Tea Party written everywhere.
Well, yeah, they do these days, right? Yeah.
I need my drummer guy.
That'd be sweet.
Where's Boner the intern?
Go ahead, yeah. Sorry.
No, so... you know, I was a huge fan of that band when I was growing up, and like reading interviews with the singer about, like, you know, his impetus for writing. And he basically said, you know, if I didn't write songs, I would hurt people. And I wouldn't say that I would go that far, but that's sort of like, you know, it's the way to hash through things and to kind of, you know, it's the sort of internal catharsis, I guess.
Wow.
Yeah,
this is good. We jumped right into this.
Yeah, yeah. Go deep, man. Go deep with Lang Freeman.
I know, and you go deep right away.
We always go deep.
You have no foreplay.
I know. Should we hug or something like that first?
No, I thought there were going to be a couple of jokes, and they didn't make fun of me. We make fun of Sonny.
We'll get there, dude.
Mexican dude in your band.
Yeah.
In my notes, I have you guys had a song in Spider-Man 3.
Mm-hmm.
This was the first sort of big career step that y'all took.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The first like big, you know, whoa, fucking Spider-Man 3.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. It was a cool thing because we, this was in, I guess, 2007, 2008. We had sort of started the band a couple of years before that and sort of recorded this record called Cinematica,
right,
which was to be our first release. And kind of the process of recording the record, we were trying to figure out a way to... recording records is extremely expensive, as you well know, and so we're trying to find a way. And at that point, it was all self-funded.
Let me also tell you, podcasts are incredibly expensive.
I bet.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
I'm looking at all the gear.
I had it all brought in for the podcast. The organ, the piano, that tambourine from the set of Waking Up Before You Go Go video by Wham.
There you go. That is
sorry,
nice.
Sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No,
you.
No, it's okay.
So records are expensive to make.
They are. So, you know, we were trying to figure out a way, you know, to see if we could make any money using the songs from the record, and also just kind of see if people would be interested.
Was the record out by then?
No,
okay,
it wasn't.
Okay, so you're trying to fund the release of the record.
Yeah, partially so. And just really at that point too, just see if anyone would be interested in releasing it, because we were, you know, a brand new band. We'd been playing for a while and had sort of built this sort of regional fan base, and we're kind of, you know, knocking at those doors and trying to find a way to sort of, you know, really kick down the door and you know, do the things that we'd planned and had wanted, and yeah, that that thing happened by just sort of an extended handshake. We'd, you know, pass the, you know, rough mixes of the record off to a friend of ours who used to manage our drummer Sonny's old band Sunflower, and Peter Raspler. Great guy. And he was in LA driving around listening to the record, and a buddy of his jumped in the car. They were going out to dinner or something like that, and just so happened to be a music supervisor who was working on stuff for Spider-Man 3. Loved the track, loved the tune, and sort of went from there.
Wow.
Yeah. So kind of, you know, luck of fate sort of deal. And it definitely helped. I mean, you know, it took us from the sort of band that you know, we were sort of in our genesis, you know, really trying to figure out what we were going to do and what we were going to be. And all of a sudden, you know, kick this door down where all of a sudden, at least that one song was in, you know, a lot of people's ears, you know, before we knew it.
How much did it help? Like did you get enough money? You got enough money to put out your album, obviously.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Well,
Spider-Man 3 is basically like $150.
We got enough money to buy a van and named it the Spider Van. And we still own Spidey.
So that's good.
Yeah, no, we decided to reinvest and you know, at that point, we had a whole bunch of label interest, and so we were sort of investing in the things that we needed to invest in, about, you know, mechanisms to tour, to do all the things that we needed to do, and hope that someone was going to pick up the record and release it.
Were you guys touring at the time? Were you like working and out there trying to build fan base and trying to get traction before the record came out and all that stuff?
Oh, absolutely.
Going out and opening. Do you have management at the time?
At that time, I don't think we did. We didn't have anyone managing the band, but, you know, we all at a certain point, you know, decided that the band, like starting bands, like it can be hilarious and fun and just a sort of like hobby sort of thing. But at a certain point when we started writing that record, everyone, you know, we had this conversation of like, look, this is the real deal. Like, I think we're all, you know, really excited creatively where we're going with it. And I think we can turn this into something that, you know, is career oriented and, you know,
outside. You can feel that. You can feel that in a band. Like,
yeah.
I've started enough bands where you can kind of, you know, you get the, all right, this is, you know.
Right.
We'll get to headline Saxon Pub at some point, but but really that's it. But then other bands you have and you're like, oh, okay, well, we can really do something.
Right.
And then you really put your nose to the grindstone and start working as hard as you can.
Absolutely. And we did that exact thing. And everyone sort of, you know, bowed in and started hitting the road as much as we could and touring. You know, it's tough, you know, anywhere. It's really expensive to do all those sorts of things.
It's so expensive.
You know, it's ridiculous. Fuel is insane. The things that you need to do to be able to do your show, something we were talking about earlier, like, you know, for us right now, and even then to say, go to Dallas and do a great show is extremely expensive, you know? So you have to have the commitment from everyone involved to, you know, to do that and be interested in that. So, and we got that, you know,
and that's another hard thing to find.
Absolutely.
Not only is it hard to find a band that makes music together that you think can do well, is also, the level of commitment from other people that used to make me freak out earlier on. But really quickly, before we go forward with all of this and we kind of learn more about Sounds Under Radio, before Sounds Under Radio, where are you from? Where were you?
I grew up, in a small town called Southlake. Right in between Dallas and Fort Worth, up in the DFW Metroplex,
and that
in the suburbs.
Yeah,
you know.
Did you have a musical family? Do you, anyone in your family is a musician or anything?
Yeah, my father actually was an old school folk singer from the '60s, and that's kind of where I got my musical start. Was for a Christmas, I think, when I was like 13 or 14, it was funny. I didn't even know this was part of his past until around then. And he bought my brother and myself, guitars, and just said, hey, you know, here's something I was really into. See if you're interested in it. And, you know, my brother was interested for a short while and I sort of dove in head first.
How many brothers and sisters?
Just one older brother. So yeah, you know, my dad definitely, I mean, he was my first guitar instructor, like, you know, just taught me old folk songs and, you know, those sorts of things. And then my brother, is a huge music consumer, like a huge fan of music. And so like he was the guy that I went to listen to new records, to right. hear new things. And, you know, he gave me Pink Floyd, The Wall, and, you know, Jeff Buckley's Grace and all those sorts of things that became like these like pinnacle, like these classic moments for me, like things that changed me.
Right.
And it changed my whole perspective musically.
Yeah. So you were already into music when he was turning you on to that. What was like the impetus? What was the turning point that you were like, okay, I'm going to do this?
You know, it's funny. I mean,
your dad gave you the guitar?
Well, no, you know, it was something that I enjoyed doing. Like, in, you know, I would spend hours and hours and hours in my bedroom, you know, practicing and playing. But when I was in high school, I'd played baseball from when I was like 4 years old up and all the way into high school. And I was actually being scouted for, like, you know, to play D1 college baseball. That was like my path. That's kind of where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do. And then
what position did you play?
Catcher. All right. I was a catcher. Yeah. And then I tore my rotator cuff when I was 17 years old and had like a big scope surgery on it. And it put me out for a couple months, and I was trying to rehab, get back, and I tore it again. And it was one of those things where it was, you know, I would be out for a year, big open surgery, you know, have to tear into my back, everything like that. And, you know, and then maybe I might be able to play baseball again. And at that point I was like, you know, I've done this for, you know, 15 years. I've loved it. I've enjoyed it, but I have this thing here, music, songwriting, that I have this new passion for. And I think maybe this is time for me to make a transition and to sort of put this past thing behind, which is a really difficult thing to do as a 17 year old kid. But, yeah,
that's when you committed yourself.
Yeah, that was kind of the thing. Is it was this whole other world that I loved and I enjoyed and that I got so much out of creatively, and things I didn't even understand yet. But it felt like it was the right thing to do. So that was kind of.
You couldn't really play when you had your rotator cuff torn, right?
Play baseball or play guitar?
Play guitar.
A bit. I could. It was way easier. Like, I couldn't throw a baseball. My rotator cuff right now is still torn. I still wake up in the middle of the night with, you know, if my arm is over my head, I'll be in a hotel room and like I have to reach over with my other hand and pull it down because it's in such pain. But, you know, it's way easier than, you know, throwing a baseball, which is impossible to do now.
Right.
So, but yeah, I had my arm strapped to the side of my body for, you know, weeks, if not a month or so, which was really weird and tough to, you know, 'cause I couldn't play guitar that way. But after a while, they, you know, doctors let me sort of open it up, and there you go.
So then you focused on guitar, and then you got out of high school. Where'd you go to? Did you go to college?
Or I did.
Did you go to school of hard knocks?
I went to college. I moved to Austin in 1999, to go to the University of Texas. And sort of the reason I chose Austin and UT was...
Say 1999?
1999, okay. Yeah. Okay. Because of the music community here. Because I kind of at that point hadn't decided that I was going to make music a complete career at that point. But I knew that it was something that I was really interested in pursuing. So, you know, Austin, Texas, being the quote-unquote live music capital of the world, was
right.
Sort of a gym, sort of a place, a good motivation to come down here so I could go to school. You know, appease my parents and appease, really, I mean, I wanted to go, and I wanted to study as well, but also sort of dive into music head first and sort of see where that took me and kind of do both at the same time.
So what was your first band Sounds at the Radio? You moved here and had some other things going.
I moved here and, joined a couple of different bands. I sort of like Bradley, the bass player, in Sounds at the Radio and songwriter as well. We sort of had very similar paths. We both moved down here. I actually met him in the dorm. We lived in the same dorm. But we came down. I played in a band. Oh, gosh, what was it called? It went through like three or four different names. I think it was Watson, Blind Arcade. That was my first thing. And I was sort of just...
Blind Arcade is a terrible name. Actually, that's great.
It was awful. It's actually Blind Arcade. It's an architecture term.
Is it really?
Yeah.
It makes it even better.
Yeah,
makes it tougher.
No. And well,
not just a bunch of blind dudes trying to play, trying to play a Mortal Kombat or something.
It's like a really bizarre version of Tommy or something like that. So yeah, no, but we called it Blind Arcade because no one would. I mean, it was way more difficult to tell the story. But no, Watson was the first name of the band, and we named it Watson because the drummer's name was Brett Watson, and he wasn't there for rehearsal, and we were trying to find a band name, and we just decided to name the band after him.
That's actually a great name, because it has that Sherlock Holmes vibe.
Yeah, exactly.
Write songs about solving capers and mysteries. Yeah,
exactly. He wasn't too happy with it, I'll say that. But so there's that, and then...
And so Bradley was in that band.
Bradley was in that band, yeah.
So you guys kind of forged a musical partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys, do you guys write the Sounds Under Radio songs together?
You know...
Or do you write them all as a band, or do you write them, or do you, they write the music, everyone writes the music, and you write the lyrics?
It's all varied, you know? Like, I'll come in, oftentimes with a completed composition, you know, top to bottom, demoed out, and run it through the filter of the other guys in the band, and you know... I always know for myself that, that the work that I create on the front end is only going to be made better by running it through those guys. We have that sort of trust and whatnot. But we, I mean, that's only one way that we write. We definitely, you know, Bradley will do the same. And other guys in the band will do the same. And on occasion we'll sit down and, you know, just four of us in a rehearsal room and try to come up with something from the beginning. That Portrait of a Summer Thief was the first song, that we actually, as a band, sat down in a room with sort of, no predisposition, and just said, let's write a song.
And that was a Spider-Man song?
Yeah, that was the tune that came out.
I'm surprised you guys didn't become the most egotistical people in the fucking world, man. I would have been like, Jesus, I wrote one song, it's fucking Spider-Man.
Well, it wasn't the first song we wrote. That was the first song we wrote as the four members collectively all at the same time together, if that makes any sense.
No. I know exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's an important moment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Nope. I've had bands like that, and I remember this song. And usually that song is like the song that defines a band that will go on to be, you know what I mean?
Oh, you know, and that element of it, I think, definitely helped us through lots of the ups and downs that we had as a band through that record and what
so
that song did for us.
Let's go to that. It's, basically, you and Bradley had that band, then you guys eventually
And Sonny was in the band as well, actually. Okay, we brought him in for a while.
Okay, so then you got Doug, and then you mm-hmm. started Sounds Under Radio.
Yeah, yeah.
You made this record, Cinematica. Peter Raspler... picked up a dude at a bar.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I'm just joking. He picked up a guy, take him somewhere. Your disc was in there. The guy happened to be Spider-Man's Uncle Steve.
Yeah, right, exactly.
He was a musical...
his supervisor.
Supervisor for, yeah. for Spider-Man. So mm-hmm. that's a guy that picks out the songs, for those of you that don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then he puts a song in the dude's hand. You guys get the song in, and then there's a label you guys are involved in a bidding war, or
sort of.
War,
I mean,
or,
funny enough, like, you know, around like lots of wars have been happening. At the same time that the Spider-Man stuff was happening, like we hadn't gone public with that information yet because it was still like contracts hadn't been signed and whatever. We had sent a whole bunch of stuff to. I mean, that was the LA side, and then we sent a whole bunch of stuff to the New York side. And got it in the hands of a whole bunch of folks, and labels were getting interested.
And this was you guys sending it yourselves.
Yeah, and I think at that
point... How did
you
do that? Hi, I'm Lang. This is my band.
Hey, how's it going?
Spider-Man likes
well,
us.
Well, Will Hoffman, the guy who produced the record, right. who now manages the band.
Okay, so he produced Cinematica before he managed the band.
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
So he was involved. He's an old friend of mine.
Yeah.
A guy that is a guy with a good business head.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And,
like a 24/7 weed smoking party boy.
I mean, he's on point. He's
yeah, he's like
on
a
point.
Guy you'd want in charge of something.
Oh, absolutely. No, he's great, man. He was a guitar player in the band Push Monkey. Yeah, and that band has. I mean, they're not done. They have never officially broke up. They don't really play many shows anymore.
I like that. But, it was so defiant the way he said. They're not done.
I mean, because every time I think that they're done, they're, you know, they have a reunion show or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
LBJ2 Electric Boogaloo is on its way out. It's being mastered right now.
Exactly.
So he was helping you out, and he had label connections.
He did. It was more actually. We were looking for press, publicity, those sorts of things around, you know, the Spider-Man thing, which
and
we knew.
His brother. Is a big time publicist,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. What is he?
Yeah,
maybe he is.
Stepbrother.
Oh, that's right. And his brother was friends.
Works for Esquire or something.
That's
Something's
right.
going on.
Yeah, yeah. His friend.
I know him.
His friends with he was friends with a guy named Keith Hagen. Who?
Oh, his brother's friends with Keith Hagen.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
And
I know Keith as well.
Yeah, and Keith's a great guy, and Keith got really interested in the band and came on board, and both the two of them began co-managing the band, and Keith lives in New York. And was really working those angles, and so
Keith and Will Hoffman, the guy that produced Cinematica, became your management team.
Correct, that's correct. Okay. And so, you know, there were, you know, while the Spider-Man thing was sort of happening on its own, we were working this other angle over here and got a whole bunch of labels interested and involved and had a whole bunch of deal offers and whatnot, and ended up signing a deal with Epic Records. And I guess it was 2007, late 2007, maybe early 2008. That was the beginning of the end.
Right. So I know that this isn't something that people really want to like delve into, but this is really like the meat of what a band becomes, is going through something like you guys
sure.
went through, and to be able to bounce back stronger even musically, and sure. probably your bond is stronger. So it's worth telling this story. Sure. So you ended up signing with Epic Records, mm-hmm. and was it did you go into it feeling like they had your back, like, oh wow, we're really here, man.
Yeah,
like, we are on Epic Records.
Absolutely. You know, and the thing I tell people too is, like, getting a record deal for our band was never a goal. Like, it wasn't the end goal. It was more right. a means to an end. Like, we had, you know, there were 10 different things in front of us that, you know, ways to release our record. And, you know, be it through indie labels, major labels, by ourselves, or various.
But this was 2007, so you could basically, the labels were...
Yeah, I mean...
People were doing their own thing, and it was actually working.
Absolutely. Right. But, you know, with what they were presenting to us and what the A&R team and the VP of the label had been setting up for this sort of, like, this new push for rock music at Epic Records, was something that we felt was really, you know, something that we would fit into really well. And, you know, the idea of, you know, of the deal and all those sorts of things was deep into the sort of philosophy of the band, like, kind of what we were doing.
We're gonna slow build. We're not gonna exactly. singles. You guys are gonna tour, and we're gonna get you on tours, and they're gonna see the live show, and you're gonna slay them every night, and then
exactly,
and then you're gonna be zillionaires.
Exactly.
Okay, so go ahead. Theoretically, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard.
It's a great idea. It wasn't a you know, we're gonna toss a you know, shit ton of money at the wall and see if, you know, this sticks, you know, if it goes to radio or whatever.
Right.
It wasn't that. It was a slow build, like, you know, let's get the band out on the road. Let's tour. Let's, you know, let's build the fan base, grassroots.
They were set. Had you guys released Cinematica?
We had not.
Okay. So you were still holding on to it.
This was about a year and a half after, you know,
did they want to release it as is?
Yeah. Yeah. There were talks about remixing it, and all those sorts of things. We did some test mixes with some other folks and they came back and everyone just agreed. It's like, you know, Will's mixes of this are like light years better than anyone else's. So let's just go with this. Let's take the record as is. And so the idea was to release the record as it was through the label. And, you know, we went through the process of artwork and all those sorts of things, and everything was ready to go. And it just, at a certain point, you know, everyone got screwed on our team. You know, I'm still really good friends with our A&R guy. This guy, Jeff Wooding, who was...
He didn't hide from you.
No, he was getting screwed just as much as everybody else was. The VP of the label, Andy Gershon, amazing guy. These are the guys that are on our team. You know, they got screwed as much as anybody else did.
So they got let go from the label?
After, you know, we ended up leaving the label, and...
You ended up leaving because no one was doing anything. There was all this big talk, and then all of a sudden you guys had already delivered a record, mm-hmm. you decided on artwork, and then it was just kind of like delayed releases or something?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was just, you know, nothing was happening on any front.
Right,
And time was passing by, and it got past the release commitment and all those sorts of things. And, I mean, like, typical story.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and we would go to our A&R guy, and you know, he just, it wasn't that he had no answers because he couldn't get any answers.
His hands are tied. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's this giant corporation. It's a bureaucracy, and nothing really moves unless people that count money want it to move. And
they're
constantly adding up what they've spent and what they've made on things.
Exactly. And at a certain point, you know, everyone in the rock world and at the label is getting the shaft, and we were definitely part of it. So, you know, we decided to leave the label.
You decided to leave,
yeah.
And you walked away.
Yeah, yeah. And it was, you know,
instead of waiting around to get months. Dropped or whatever and get $50,000 or some shit. That
well,
they, you
know. we left and you know,
oh,
there
they
were
gave
six,
us some money?
I mean, they owed us money at that point.
Oh, that's good.
So, you know, we left, got our record back. But the unfortunate thing was this was 2.5 years after the record had been mastered, you know. So, you know, we had creatively moved on and had written, you know, two more records and, and were just waiting to do them, you know, and we still hadn't released this first record.
And so you took that back?
Mm-hmm. We got the record back.
That, what, the whole signing thing, the whole getting signed and then leaving the label only took 6 months?
Oh, no, 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 no.
A year and a half.
Well, there was, you know,
from
6 months.
From when you signed to when you signed the exit form.
There was probably 6 months of contract negotiations getting in. You know, there was a year with the label, and then there were 6 months of, you know, legal work to get out, to get our record back.
All right.
And so all of a sudden we're 3 years out from, you know, like from the day that it was mastered to when we actually got to release the record.
So
on
weird,
our own.
Isn't it?
Oh, it was unbelievable. You know, it was a total fantasy and, you know, total nightmare. And
so were you guys ever on the verge of like, you know, I don't think I can do this anymore.
Oh,
or did you?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we have band meetings at Trudy's. And
after like five margaritas.
Oh yeah. It was like, oh, I love you, man. This is great. No, but you know, the thing is we released that record. You know, everyone was just super jazzed and super excited to kind of be done with that situation and have our record back and kind of take back the reins and kind of be aggressive on our own end again and say, man, let's just do this. You know, like we stand behind the art, we stand behind the creative work. And let's put it out. So we did, and you know, we toured our asses off, you know, all across the
you
country.
Did.
Yeah. Oh,
you
yeah.
Have been, I mean, I've you know, I've been around you since then.
Yeah, you know, we hit the road, man. We hit the ground running. We were doing, you know, 150, 200 dates a year, you know, for 2 years.
Shit,
you know.
Really? And how were you doing? Were you guys doing your own shows? Were you going all over the United States? Were you focusing on one area?
You know,
were you building a.
We in the beginning were all over the country.
Okay. That's, you know, a hard thing to do.
It's really hard because the thing that we found, and I mean, you know, we're better now because we learned all these sort of lessons. But you know, you go to Albany, New York, and you may gain 50 new fans in Albany.
But when are you going to go back there?
Right, and it's, you know, because it costs so much money to get up there. So we refocused at a certain point and started focusing on Texas, the South, like, you know, the Midwest, or not, Midwest was sort of the secondary target, but like the Southern states, places that we could be at home and sort of target and hit, you know, as much with frequency so that we could really genuinely start building a fan base.
Right. And so you did.
We did. Yeah.
And you guys have a pretty solid fan base. You go out and tour now. I mean,
yeah, you know, we don't, you know, I would love right now to jump in the van or get in a bus or whatever and just go all over the country and play shows everywhere. It's just not economically feasible at this point. It's so expensive to do. And you know, we have the most success targeting things and, you know, going to the major markets.
I think everyone does. I mean, I've almost, not always, but for the last like 10 years, I've kind of looked at touring almost like before anybody should be allowed to book a band or book a tour or anything, they should play the game Risk.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't just go out and take over the entire map in front of you.
No.
You have to get strongholds in places before you move into other places. And absolutely, while it seems small-minded and stuff, you're never going to make it out there with the solid fan. Even if you have like a single and it does well, that's such a... It's not like going touring and actually getting fans from them experiencing you live. You know?
Right, yeah. I mean, the most success that we had touring outside of our sort of arc was whenever we would go on the road with larger acts and, you know, you'd be playing.
Who all have you toured with?
This band Red, they're a great rock band from Nashville. This band Sick Puppies. And then we've done a whole bunch of spot dates with, it seems like, every band from the 90s. Like Alice in Chains, Toad the Wet Sprocket, which was, they were actually really badass. They were really good. Way more.
Every time I hear that song, I mean, every time I hear that name, I hear that song. So
yeah, no, they're
not my
great
jam.
No, it's all right.
No. I mean that song. You know, all I want is to feel your face. I'm not gonna sit here and diss Toad the Wet. Who else? Were they nice?
They were really sweet dudes. They were really
good. I saw this singer guy play one night at Largo in LA. I'm pretty sure I did.
Really? He was doing a lot of solo stuff for a while.
Right.
But I think they do, you know, one tour a year or something like that.
So who else? You're about to open for Bush.
Yeah.
I actually have the date of that. That's at the on August 17th at Stubbs.
Yeah, like on Bush Wednesday. Yeah, yeah. It's just, that should be fun. We just found out the show's sold out, so That should be cool. It's my first time actually playing that outdoor stage.
I saw them.
Really?
I saw them. I can't remember exactly what year it was, but Moby opened, and I saw them at the Irwin Center, kind of like a last minute, because I liked them a lot. I still do. I thought they were a really cool band.
Yeah.
And because it was straight up. It was like when I was in Gowdy, and I remember it was, I guess it was around the time when our record was done, and we had gone through all these times where, I don't know if you guys do, you guys play, it's a lot more feasible now. This was in like 2000 or 1999, when technology wasn't as good as it is now. But do you guys use tracks or anything when you play? Or
Like the sequences. Loops
playing or something?
Absolutely, yeah.
We were going back and forth a lot about that. And I remember going to see Bush, and I went with my ex-wife, and we when I got home, I immediately called our guitar player, who was always like, oh, we got to have loops, we got to have this. And I was always like, man, first of all, it takes away the chance for you to ever branch out live. And just in the nature of the area that, I don't know how you grew up musically, but I mean, I grew up like slugging it out three sets, you know, in Corpus Christi, and you got to make shit long. And then you eventually, it's not that I've ever wanted to be a jam guy, or I am a jam guy, but if a jam is going, you don't have to jump out because this fucking thing's gonna stop.
Right, you want to be able to pursue it.
Right. Yeah. So I was incredibly, when I went to go see Bush, and it must have been pretty much their last tour, or second to last tour, because it was, you know, they've been gone for a number of years.
Yeah.
It was four dudes.
Yeah.
It's like a drummer, a bass player, a guitar player, and a dude that sang and played guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Boom.
Yeah.
And it sounded awesome.
Yeah.
You know.
And they had no tracks, no sequences, anything like that.
No.
Oh wow.
Nothing. It was just a rock and roll band.
That's crazy.
And that's when I was like, man, I don't want to do that stuff. And I mean, now it's easier to use it. The other thing is then, and I know I talked about this in the last podcast, and I don't want to make it seem like I don't want to play bars, because that's really all I fucking play. Yeah. But there's a certain level of production you can't really rely on in there unless you have your own sound man, you have some kind of thing. And all of that costs money, not just getting to Dallas, buying this, you know, $2,500 machine and program that's going to run your stuff, and then also a dude that knows it's actually going to happen, because you know, you got some yahoo out there smoking weed during the first song, it comes in, you got a thing going, it's not even playing. It's like,
oh yeah, I mean, it's tough. I mean, you know, we try to take, even into bars, I mean, it's so difficult to do, but like, take this sort of stadium size rock show, we bring lighting production, all those sorts of things, everything is pre-programmed and triggered and all those sorts of things internally, so that we don't have to hire out all those folks. Now, you know, we used to travel with our own front of house engineer, and it would be lovely if we could afford to do so.
But I mean, also here you got all this stuff that you can do on stage, even your own lights, but you can't bring up this guitar solo, or
bring up
the backing vocals if they're not good enough in the room, or
it's a massive thing, man. I mean, it's a huge. I mean, when we,
so what all do you guys run? I mean, I don't want to fucking
give away the secrets.
Yeah, I don't want to pull back the curtain.
No, I mean, like, our show is sequenced, timed from top to bottom. Now, don't get me wrong, kind of what we were talking about earlier, like pursuing the jam.
Right.
Like, there are moments that we can get off of it and do that. But, you know, the goal is to sort of have, like, our show, we try to like bring forth this like element of theater, right? Like, we want it to be a show, a performance, more than just four dudes getting up on stage and playing some songs and calling it a day.
You get that from your music and also like the artwork and all that stuff.
Cool.
There's a lot of thought put into the presentation, which is another thing that sort of takes you out of a local band kind of thing. Like, there's a lot of, like, you guys have a look to, it's not even so much, you have a look to yourselves like a band does, but you also have a look to your artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And so almost kind of like when you see something, like if you see a poster, you think, oh, I wonder if that sounds underrated, because it would have this sort of vibe.
Right,
and look and feel to it.
I mean, you know, and this is, that gets into the sort of like,
who does that? Is that you, or is that you guys, or do you work with artists? Or?
I mean, it's conceptually, it's all internal, you know, and a lot of the artwork, Sonny does a lot of the artwork for the band, but we have sort of a core group of people that we work with creatively in the visual sense that do a lot of that stuff. Like Jeff Ray is this amazing director and photographer.
Now, you guys have a lot of videos. That's what I was going to say that. I mean, you have a lot of, and the videos are good. Like, they're not, you know.
Yeah, Jeff is this guy from Austin. He's like, I think he's we started working with him when he was like 20 years old. He's like 24 years old now. Does these amazing things.
That's like, the funniest amount of time. Like, dude, we started working with him when he was 20. Now he's 24.
Now he's 24.
You believe what he can fucking do with a pencil.
Years. It's crazy. No, but like, you know, we convinced when we were on Epic, we convinced our A&R folk to let him direct a video for us.
That's hard to do.
It was huge. I mean, you know, this kid, like, who's done a handful of, you know, videos for no money, but could prove himself the fact that he could do these amazing videos for no money. And that was kind of the deal. It was like, well, you know, you want us to spend this huge budget on this. Well, that's going to come out of our pocket in the end. So why don't we spend, you know, 5% of that and have our buddy do it, who's going to do just as kick-ass of a job, and we trust him creatively to do it. And they bit and they did it, and he directed a
so
great
when he
video.
Directs and it gets it's less expensive. Are you does he have like lighting people? Does he still have like a bit of a crew, or he just has that much of a
funny?
He does his own editing.
He does all his own editing. The video for the single off our new record, Sing. We had him come out to shoot a live show. We were doing like a hometown rock show at Stubbs, and he just shot it, and that's what it was going to be. It was going to be a live performance thing. And then he calls me one day, and he's like, "Man, this stuff's looking really good. Like, why don't I get you? Let's go out and let's shoot in a field. And I just want to have an hour, and we'll do that, and just get you, you know, sing the song a couple times." So just went out and did that, and he's like, "Man, that looks really good. Let's get the band and let's go, you know, to this, you know, this little area, and let's shoot the band. And man, I'm gonna cut together all these, you know, these free videos that I've found online." And all of a sudden, he just shoots us this edit of it. It's like, wow, this was supposed to be a live video, and this is like. Like in and of itself, creative and moving, you know, just visually by itself. So he has that sort of, you know, that's in him. He just did the new Blocktober video, actually, for the song The Chills, which is a great video.
I think I might have seen that. So, well, then let's, okay, so then Cinematica came out. You toured 200 dates a year. Where did you get to this album? Did you write it like back then, or did you write it after you were kind of...
It's funny, when I went through a massive stint of writer's block after the record, I was just really angry because of sort of the business shit that we had gone through.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Like, you know, if you and your band can come out of it, you come out the other side, you can either come out like punch drunk, or you can come out really a lot stronger.
Totally. I mean, and there were moments where, man, I didn't think it was going to work. I didn't think it was going to survive. And I didn't think that the band wanted or needed to continue. But, you know, we slowly started, you know, we took some time off from the road, slowly started writing material again together. I began writing a lot of my own, Bradley, you know, himself and everyone else in the band. And, you know, we kind of came back together and sort of made this decision at a certain point. We started analyzing the material, saying, like, look, here's what we have. We've gone through the ups and downs, and we're in this huge low point right now. What can we do to get ourselves out of it? Two, do we even want to go down that path again? And what we broke it down to was the songs. We'd always, no matter what, had success with people hearing the songs at the core, the creative nature of what we do, and that being the thing that sort of brought us back up. And so, one, we made that decision of, okay, we stand behind this creatively now. We've come out of all this stuff and are really happy with where we are creatively and excited again. And so let's use that as the sort of springboard to see if we can rebuild this thing.
Right.
And that's exactly what we did. It was, you know, we had no money. You know, we'd spent all of our money working that record, touring. You know, there were moments where it was like, okay, well, you know, if this doesn't
work,
you're
gonna have to sell the spider van.
Exactly. No joke. It was like, we have to sell the spider van tomorrow. If this doesn't happen, you know, it's true. It was sad.
Well, I love that the spider van is the thing that hangs in the balance.
It's so true, man. It's true. There was a moment where we were playing this show. We were driving up to Dallas to play the show, and like the van was kind of acting up, and we stopped and like got it checked out, like, you know, somewhere in Round Rock, and like, you know, we didn't have money to fix the van, you know, and it was like, what are we supposed to do? Like, how are we going to continue to be a band if we can't make music, if we can't play the music, you know, we can't get there to do it, you know? So it was just, you know, it got low, got pretty bad, but, you know, we all sort of rallied around what we are, the things that we were creating. And, you know, and just decided, you know, we're going to make this the best thing that it possibly can. It doesn't matter, you know, if we have no money to do it, we're going to figure out a way to do it. And we did. And, you know, as we sort of started, you know, recording this new record, things started happening and people started really responding to the songs, and, you know, we were getting placements here and there and TV and film, and all of a sudden these revenues were coming in to where, you know, it went from, you know, can we afford to, you know, fix the shocks in the van to like, well, can we hire a PR person to work the new single, you know? And it was all founded on, the songs, you know, just breaking it down to the core. So that, for me, that's one thing about this new record and about our band that I think I'm the most proud of, is that, you know, through all of the business shit and through all of the sort of the ups and downs that you go through as a band, everybody's gone through them. And you know,
the pitfalls that were presented to you, that you chose not to go down.
Right.
You
know, exactly. And we came out on the other side, you know, as triumphant as we could be, you know, based on the merit of like our art and the creativity. So that's
what a great story, man.
Thank you.
That really is. I mean, it's such a, that's an uplifting, like a good story.
Thank you very much.
So you go to make this, you've gotten songs from this record place, you said?
Yeah. Similar situation, you know, we're similar situation as to the first record. We had started recording the record and we decided, you know, we had the grouping of songs we were going to record for the record.
Right.
We blocked it off to where, because so much time had passed from when we'd released our first record, we decided we wanted to get something out sooner than later. So we recorded an EP's worth of material and then started working on an EP's worth of material, which is basically the first half of this record, which we called My Communist Heart. And then there was going to be the, you know, companion to it, which was going to be My Capitalist Mind. But we decided to merge them together at a certain point. But anyway, recorded the first, you know, grouping of songs, released that. And through that release, you know, people sort of, you know, the energy sort of started spinning again around the band, and, you know, placement started happening, and those sorts of things started kind of filing in again, which was very nice and very helpful and wonderful.
That's amazing. Oh, what a great story. And so when you recorded this record, you said you started doing it on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys started recording at your house, where I went and did the thing with Taylor, just like straight up.
Yeah. You know, oh yeah, I forget. You recorded, you know, we recorded Taylor Davis's record in that, you know.
Fantastic record, man.
Man, I love that record. Awesome. I'm so happy with it. And your tambourine skills are like ridiculous and mad.
Guys,
like,
seriously, get on iTunes right now. Buy this record. You will never hear tambourine like this.
It's the truth. It's the crux.
And Taylor did a great job. You guys, it was all around really good.
Thank you. Yeah, and we did it in my house. You know, I have a control room. My bed is in my closet, and my control room is what used to be my bedroom, you know? And you know, we started doing demos for the Sounds and Radio record, in there, and, brought on Will Hoffman again, to produce, most of the record. He and I kind of sort of co-produced, this record. And I, you know, the songs that I produced, I cut mostly in that space. And Will has a studio that sort of floats around. It's basically him and his gear that just wherever it lands.
He had it in the place where we rehearse.
That's right. In Dave Murray. Dave Murray's place. Yeah. That was a cool place. We used that piano a number of times on the record. And it's a great piano. Yeah. So yeah, you know, we started making that record and, you know, recorded the first part of it. And, a guy who we had done, some work with before on a movie called War Games 2, which was the sequel to
the War Games.
Yeah, a game.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a directed DVD thing, but he was a music supervisor. We did a song with him for that a couple years ago, and he now supervises a whole bunch of shows. One being the show The Vampire Diaries on the CW network, and we always sort of reconnected with him during South by Southwest. And you know, he'd heard the new material and had a slot for a tune that he thought would be great for us to write a song for. And so, this was, oh my gosh, when was this? It was South by Southwest, you know, 2 years ago, maybe. Right. And, we were sort of in the process of recording a record and, tossing some demos for tunes that had not made the cut or that we were working on. And he chose actually a tune that was a demo that I had done sort of on my own, you know, on a little four track recorder. And he said, I love that. I want that in 4 days. And so we had to go in and cut it. And, you know, 4 days later it was on TV, you know, scoring the end of this show. Like,
that's awesome.
It was great. And in a really cool way, like, we didn't change the arrangement of the tune one bit. It was top to bottom, the exact same arrangement that I had kind of placed out for it, and sort of scored this last 5 minutes of this show, and it was great. And that whole thing, this song called All You Wanted, sort of kind of kickstarted a whole bunch of stuff. They have that show has a really, really great core fan base. And
that's what I was going to ask. So shows like that, like, on did you see some kind of did you see the response from?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that was sort of our first introduction to Twitter and the power of Twitter. It's crazy because we, you know, that came out.
Tweet.
Yeah. People retweet, and like, those people really do. And they want to talk about the music and they want to spread the community. So, you know, we, you know, just when the song aired, we, you know, did everything that we could to let everybody know who it was and what it was. And, you know, the response to it was overwhelming and amazing and positive. You know, we were able to put that song with a handful of others up on iTunes for about 30 days because that song was going to be on the soundtrack for the show. And they were going to release a compilation soundtrack for the show. And, the response was amazing. Like, I mean, you could see it in the sales, like the number of people that downloaded the song, and it was amazing. It was great. And those fans to this day are still really supportive of what we do.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So it's great to sort of tap into that, you know.
Do they dress like vampires?
They don't dress like vampires, but it's a lot of black. Yeah. A little black dude, which
you guys,
I love the black.
You guys
t-shirts.
Are a black band.
We are. We're total black band.
It's a black band.
Yeah. We did this promotional tour around the show when the soundtrack album was released. They toured some of the cast and as well as us to these malls around,
right? Yes,
which was hilarious. I've never fucking played a mall in my entire life. I never thought I would.
Dude, did someone go there and run sound for you guys? Was it that? Oh no, maybe I saw Will and he was going with you guys.
Yeah, oh yeah, he went with us. Okay. For those. But man, you know. 6,000, 8,000 13-year-old girls screaming at the top of their lungs, like, it was an intense experience, you know, like, that is devotion, that's fandom,
you know? They responded to the songs as well, not just the guys from the show.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you know, it was interesting because I was really interested to see what the response would be like. And, you know, the songs, we'd had a handful of songs in that show. All You Wanted was the one that was the most feature. And, you know, lots of people, you know, up in, I think we did one in Chicago, Dallas, and in Florida. I think we're in Miami, and far away from home, you know, Chicago, Miami, people singing every word back to us from that song. It was a pretty amazing experience.
That's awesome. Have you been able to go back to these places? Haven't yet. What's your touring stance now? Were you out on tour? Hopefully people are listening to this all over the world.
Yeah. Right now we're in the middle of a radio campaign, working Sing, the single.
It's
from
a great
the
song.
Record.
That's a song that I played at the top, and yeah. I'll play the whole thing on the way out.
Awesome. So yeah, we're working that, and we're sort of kind of going nationally where that picks up. You know, like, we're doing a radio festival in Flagstaff.
Right. I read about the 103.9.
Mm-hmm. So we're doing that, and then.
And is that the station was having competition? Have songs, or they were playing the song on the radio?
No, they've been playing it on the radio. Okay. It's kind of been, you know, they're.
Have you gotten any other radio play with that song?
Yeah, you know, it's been sparse. It's been, you know, hit or miss. But like, there's pockets all over the country that are kind of spinning it, and we're hoping.
Are you,
you
able
know,
to make it out to those pockets while the song's on the radio?
Well, this is what we're hoping to do, and that's the goal. That's kind of where we're at right now.
Is that a hard thing to do? Because in some way, does it feel like you're like chasing? You're chasing. Something that might have happened 2 weeks ago, you know.
Oh,
I mean?
Absolutely, because you get the barometer, you get the. Right. I mean, you get the numbers a couple of weeks later, and you're like, "Oh shit! Well, we need to be there playing for those people." You
can't
know what
really
mean?
Book much more than a month out.
Well,
so
right,
like,
exactly. Especially when you're talking about traveling 1,000, 1,500 miles, and you know, scheduling all those sorts of things. So we're doing the best that we can with that right now. It's a struggle, but you know. We're doing what we can, and while that's all happening, we're sort of centering around Texas and the South to hit our major markets where we have pockets of fans and doing that thing.
So you play in Dallas?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you play in Houston?
Dallas, Houston, San Antonio. I'm trying to think where we've hit recently. We did a whole Midwest run just recently, like up through Tulsa and then over into like Nashville and back and through Louisiana. So kind of that's kind of...
You try and hit those like once every couple of months or once every three or four months?
We try. No, like, no, I understand. You know, it's, you know, the goal for the places that we, you know, have pockets of fans is doing something every, I think, 45 days or something like that. We don't always reach that goal, but, you know, we try as much as we can.
That's great.
So.
That's great. It's amazing that you guys have been able to survive sort of these, you know, you've been handed really great opportunities that you know, were followed with, you know, some pretty tough times.
Yeah.
But you made the most of it. And that's really, I mean, it's a very exciting story. I hope those of you that haven't heard of Sounds on the Radio, you'll go out and hear.
Well, I'll say this too, and this isn't to totally stroke your ego, but, you know, we were huge fans of Gowdy and Peep Show.
And so exactly, part of this whole thing is that I usually, like the last 5 minutes of the interview, I sit back into this chaise lounge and I take off my shirt, strip down to just a bikini underwear, and I have the guest shower me with affection. No, go ahead. Well, sorry.
No, but it's totally true. But, you know, I know you guys had your, you know, trials and tribulations with the major label world.
We didn't make it through the major label. Like, you know, two of us did.
Well, right. But you came out on the other side and wrote and recorded a great record. And released a great record. And, you know, when we were going through that process, it was like, look, this can be done. You can do this.
Right.
You know, like,
well, thank you.
You know, it was inspiring to kind of see where, you know, what had happened to your career and sort of paralleling it with where we were.
Right.
And saying, look, you know, you don't have to have all this shit. Like, you know, it's just about writing great songs and, you know, let's do that. You know, and that was sort of the mirror that we saw from you. For sure.
Just now when you were explaining that, I was thinking of you going back to your rehearsal thing and going like, guys, we don't even have to play music. Let's just have our friends over and talk.
It's great.
Johnny's doing it, man. It's fucking awesome.
It's badass, dude.
Well, Lang, this has been a great and a very informative. I'm glad that we were able to, that you were so open about your work. And you guys have shows all coming up. We talked about it the 17th at Stubbs.
Best place to look for stuff about our band is our website, soundsunderradio.com, or Facebook Sounds Under Radio, Twitter, SirTweet, S-U-R-Tweet.
Is there anything else you want to say?
Man, this is a cool thing. I appreciate you doing this. Thanks. And talking to people, because this is the kind of show that I'd like to listen to.
Yeah.
You know? So,
if I get enough people on the show, then we'll actually have an audience, because everyone that was on the show at one point is listening to it.
Exactly.
But
I think
this is helpful. I think it's nice to be able to go on and talk to someone in a longer format than, where are you playing tonight? What's the name of your album? Why did you do that? What happened that time when you guys broke down in a van?
Well, right, yeah. And from my perspective, too, it's like, you know, I know where you're coming from, like, and what you've done, like, creatively and artistically. Right. And it's not like some person I know nothing about who,
some freaky fan
that
wrote this on Craigslist.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, you've got your thing, you know, and I've enough respect for what you
Thank
do
you.
to
Well, likewise, your music, your album, My Communist Heart.
It's Where My Communist Heart Meets My
Where My Communist Heart Meets My Capitalist Mind.
Yeah.
Is for sale right now. I got it on iTunes. There's a video on there.
Mm-hmm.
For Sing.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. So everyone go out, buy this record. I'm going to play Sing right now. And I guess you sure there's nothing else you want to say? No one you want to
insult?
Is
there anything else I need to say?
Like, don't that, like? Is there?
I don't know. I wish my band was here, that we, you know, they could chime in.
I know.
I'll see them later, though. We're doing a rehearsal this evening.
Well, tell them I said hi. I'm trying to figure out how to deal with more than one-on-one.
That's tough when you deal with like four people,
right?
Like, and you're trying to get something out of. There has to be a spokesperson, you know.
Right.
And you know, I'm happy to be that for my band, but I feel like sometimes I let my guys down. Like, I don't, you know, I don't speak their word, you know.
Well, I mean,
it's tough.
You know, you do what you can. I understand that position. But well, thank you for coming, and thanks for coming to my apartment. Drinking all of my water.
I know. We gotta need to turn the AC back on. It's fucking hot in here.
All these these fractures I've displayed, but we still hold on, 'cause it was all.
So that was my interview with Lang Freeman from Sounds Under Radio. That song right there is called All You Wanted. It was in the Vampire Diaries, a CEW show, as you heard on the show. I mean, I think that went pretty well. That was a really interesting conversation. I enjoyed, I always enjoy talking to Lang. We've gone on trips out of town together and always pretty much talked the whole time, kind of turned each other on to music and had great conversations. So my best to Sounds Under Radio and their new album. And I hope it all goes really well for them. So as I said before, it's my 20th anniversary of moving to Austin. I know that because it was Will Sexton's birthday in 1991. And I moved up here and I went to his birthday party at a place called 311, which I don't think is there anymore. It was on 6th Street. So tonight I'm going to the Saxon Pub for his birthday. It was the same kind of thing. I'd like to wish Will a really happy birthday. I think I'll get him on the show at some point. That might be a little hard to have a conversation between the two of us because we might have known each other too long. Anyway, hopefully it all goes well. I have episode 3 with Nathan Singleton from Sideshow Tragedy and of course, the great Donnie Wynn. He's an amazing musician. Anyway, I will get Sounds Under Radio to play you out. This is their song, Sing, and I hope you enjoy it. Thank you to Lang for coming on the show. Thank you for listening. Once again, if you have comments, suggestions, or anything, please post them on my Facebook or email me or post them here on the site on the Podbean site. All right, thank you. Bye. It's not you.